Hey, welcome back to Keepin' Cozy. Today we have a really cool guest, Anthony Scaramucci the Mooch. You probably remember him from his infamous stay as Director of Communications at the Trump White House. He only spent 11 days there, but he's got a lot to talk about. Today we talk a little bit more about those infamous 11 days, how he got his nickname the Mooch, and just how he grew up as a Long Island kid and went on to be a rockstar hedge fund dude. So please be sure to like, comment, and subscribe, and share with anyone who you think may find it cool. Thanks again.
Let's rock and roll. You ready?
Yeah. So the first question I have for you, Mr. Scaramucci, thank you for being on the podcast, is what is the story behind the nickname the Mooch?
Well, I mean, so you grew up in a world of political correctness. I did not grow up in a world of political correctness. So I had a German phys ed teacher in the first grade. He was a very rough guy. He did not like kids who had four syllable last names. So it could have been a Krajewski, a Scaramucci, a John B. Nicola. It didn't matter. He didn't like it. And so, he probably would have been fired today in the age of political correctness. So there I am in the first or second grade. My last name is Scaramucci. That's four syllables. He picked the third syllable of my name, Mooch, and he started calling me Mooch. Mooch, do this. Mooch, do that. Hey, Mooch. Okay. And I had no idea that it was a pejorative. I didn't know that it meant to be mooching off of people or taking their stuff. And so I thought it was a cool nickname. And so I had that nickname. It carried with me my varsity. I played football in high school and I was the quarterback on the team. And my varsity jacket had Mooch on it, you know? And so yeah. I've been called Mooch my entire life, probably 47 years of being called the Mooch. Obviously, when I got into the White House, the liberal press loved the pejorative nature of that name, and so they kept using it every 5 seconds. Enjoyed it. I don't know. I must be a little bit of a weirdo, but I thought it was fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, can you talk us a little bit through your life in pursuing the American dream from being the son of a construction worker up until those infamous 11 days that you spent in the White House?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty basic story. You know, you grew up in Jericho. I grew up in Port Washington. I think the first thing about my story is a lot of luck involved. So Port Washington is a very rich neighborhood on the coast. It has a middle class neighborhood and an upper middle class neighborhood in Beacon Hill. We lived in sort of the blue collar middle class neighborhood. So my neighbors were sheetrock installers. They were plumbers and landscapers. They were police officers. They were people that worked in sanitation. And my dad worked as a crane operator. So it was a great time in America because people like my father, who did not have a college education, could still make enough money to afford what I would call a small salt box Cape Cod sort of a house. If you've ever been to Levittown, you know, You've seen those houses. That is the miracle of the American dream. You know, this is sort of the post GI world, the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The United States is an industrial power, and blue collar people are making reasonably good income so they can afford a middle class lifestyle. And so I live resoundingly in the middle class, Jacob. I would never tell anybody I grew up poor. I would never dishonor my dad's work ethic by telling anybody that. So we had air conditioning. We put them in and out of the windows. There's no central air or anything like that. We had one bicycle we shared. My brother and I shared a room. There was a budget. If my dad's work got cut back, there was financial anxiety. And I think that's what propelled me to Wall Street. So, but I used to sit at my dad's dinner table. You had to be there at 5:15. If you didn't get there at 5:15, he'd hit you with something. It was no nonsense in that house. And he's a rough guy. But his thing was, you're going to go to school, you're going to study, you're going to go to college, and someday you're going to live on the water in Sands Point. You're going to get rich. Because that's what America's about, okay? He was a very aspirational blue-collar person. Yeah. 42 years at the same construction company. The sand pits where my dad worked has now been fully excavated, and there's a beautiful public golf course there. And so that's my backstory. I ended up going to Tufts and Harvard Law School. I had to take on a lot of school debt to do that. I also hustled. I had some reasonably good summer jobs. My dad got me into the union, actually. I worked as a laborer one summer. It was $16 an hour in the summer of 85.
Yeah.
And so that's a big number. You know, it's probably like $30 an hour today, $35 an hour. And I was able to save money for school. When I got into Harvard, my mother thought it was Hartford. I mean, she had no clue. She had the map out Labor Day weekend. She was driving to Hartford, Connecticut. I'm like, Mom, it's not Hartford Law School. It's Harvard Law School. She's like, well, why would they call it Hartford Law School if it's not in Hartford? I'm like, Mom, it's not Hartford Law School. So my parents were big readers. They were high school graduates. They loved their kids. They were hardworking people. And they afforded me that platform, that opportunity. So you know this from your life. We don't control where we're born. We don't control the family we grew up in. We don't control our physical makeup, our intellectual brain power. But once we're here and once we're formed, excuse me, it's up to us to propel ourselves. It's up to us to improve ourselves. It's up to us to figure out what we want to do. And so I went to law school because I thought it was a ticket out.
Yeah.
And the lawyers back then were making 2x what my dad was making. And that was a first year starting salary. So I was like, that's going to be enough money for me. Yeah. I didn't realize I hated it until I got in it.
So, well, I have a question about just, you know, entering Harvard Law and then eventually going on to Goldman Sachs and, you know, perhaps the White House. What was it like for you to navigate those kinds of elite spaces as the son of a construction worker, first generation?
Well, it was not easy. I wrote a book called Goodbye, Gordon Gekko, How to Find Your Fortune Without Losing Your Soul. I authored that book in like 2009, published it in 2010. And I talked about the self-consciousness of it. I talked about the awkwardness of it. And there's a scene in the book where I'm wearing a 100% polyester suit. I got a polyester shirt on and a polyester tie. I mean, I'm fully flammable for my first Goldman Sachs interview. And I walk in, I'm answering the questions well, and I'm listening and I'm giving the right answers. The guy looks at me, says, man, you are the worst dressed person that we've met at the Harvard Law School. And I'm like looking at him, I'm like, what are you talking about? This is my best threads. I mean, what are you talking about? And he said, listen, you're going to have to go to Brooks Brothers or a place like that and buy some real clothing, natural fiber clothing. You need a cotton shirt and a woolen suit. I can't invite you down to Goldman Sachs unless you're appropriately dressed. And that was a big adjustment for me. I didn't know that world. I never was a member of a country club. I was never a member of a I didn't hit a tennis racket, anything like that. And so, yeah, it was rough. I didn't necessarily fit in, but I'll tell you what, these were unbelievable organizations. Goldman Sachs was an unbelievable organization. I learned a lot there. Once I had paid off my school debt, I was committed to my strategy, Jacob, which is I was going to own my own business. And so at the age of 32, I left Goldman and started a registered investment company, which grew to be a success. And we sold that company 5 years later to Neuberger Berman. And then Neuberger got bought by Lehman, and now I'm at Lehman. Lehman was quite a good company as well. Unfortunately, they had the bankruptcy issue in 2008, which could have been avoided, but that's for another podcast. But I had already left. I left Lehman in 05 to start SkyBridge, and less my 11-day fiasco in Washington, I've been at SkyBridge for the last 15 years.
What was it like when you started to become more assimilated into those kinds of elite spaces? Because now, you know, you run your own, you know, SALT talks, you run your own conferences, and you were, you know, director of communication.
When I become more assimilated, I'll let you know. Okay, you'll be the first person I call. I'll pick up the phone and say, "Hey, Jacob, I feel like I'm assimilated." You never feel, when you grow up like me, you never feel assimilated. I'm just being candid with you.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean I don't like the people I'm hanging out with. It doesn't mean that I'm not, you know, part of the group, and doesn't mean I feel like necessarily an outsider. But I'm still tied to my family. I'm still tied to the clammers in my family and the auto glass people in my family and the deli operators in my family and the plumber in my family. You know, so, and I live 2 miles from my folks. I live in Manhasset. They live in Port Washington.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, the blessing of my life, and there's been many blessings, thank God, and you have to have blessings. Every entrepreneur, Jacob, knows that there's some element of luck and providence in your success.
Yeah.
And so for me, the blessing of my life is I appreciate both sides of the equation. The blessing of my life is I don't feel threatened by rich people and I don't look down on poor people. The blessing for me is that I've been able to see the continuum of that in my life. And I remember when my parents got their washer and dryer. I was in the 8th grade.
Yeah.
And my mother no longer had to walk with her mother, my grandmother, to the laundromat to do the laundry. Remember how happy my parents were about that, you know? And so to me, I've been able to almost like have that accordion of seeing all the gradations of what goes on. But yeah, no, I don't necessarily feel, I mean, look, I'm a little bit of a renegade. You figured that out, right? Look at my career. I'm a little bit of a renegade. I got a little bit of a potty mouth. I'm going to tell you what I think. People that conform and quote unquote fit in, they don't act like me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm sure that's true. But here's a question about like the kind, like that those kinds of elite spaces, right? So, you know, when you were at Harvard Law, one of your classmates ended up becoming Barack Obama, or, you know, was Barack Obama who ended up becoming president. I remember in the 2012 debate, Mitt Romney was talking to Barack Obama and told him that he picks the losers. And he mentioned Tesla in, you know, as one of the losers, you know, companies that Obama supported in 2012. But, you know, to have even heard of Tesla in 2012 shows a level of, you know, insight and to an extent, perhaps privilege that, you know, the average person wouldn't really know. So how fortunate and how much of, you know, do you think success is just tied towards being able to be in those elite spaces and have that information about what's going on?
It's a big factor. I mean, you have to recognize that it is a big factor. Having said that, you have to also make sure that you have, there's a ladder for people. So I always tell my friends, I'm interested in dropping that ladder down to help other people that were similarly situated to me climb up that ladder and experience the life that I've experienced. I'm not interested in pulling up the ladder. And yeah. So you're asking me a direct question. I'm going to give you an honest answer. Of course, people that have privilege and people that go to schools that are upper echelon schools and they're networked into super wickedly smart people have a material advantage relative to other people. What I would say to you is John F. Kennedy said something, probably stole it from George Bernard Shaw, but he said something that was very true about life. It's very axiomatic. Life is unfair. If you're expecting fairness for life or equity, you're on the wrong planet, you're living in the wrong civilization, and you're living in the wrong animal species known as man and womankind. So life is unfair, and what you have to do with your life is have no expectations. You have to do with your life, have no entitlements. You can't look at somebody else's life and say, hey, that should be my life. Or you can't say, oh, you know, I'm poor, you're rich, why do you need all that money? Give me some of that money.
Yeah.
Do you follow what I'm saying?
And yeah, so, no, I see what you're saying. I think
so that life is unfair. I mean, I can't tell you the number of people that I come in contact with and they say, well, here are my grievances. Here are my complaints. Here's my victimhood.
Yeah.
And my response to that is you got to get over that quickly. You know, you're how old are you?
22.
Okay. So you're as old as my kids. Okay. I have a 27-year-old that just graduated from Stanford Business School. A 24-year-old that went to Brown, and my 20-year-old is actually working with rappers like The Baby, Little Baby, Machine Gun Kelly. He's in the video space in LA, dropped out of college, okay, and he's doing these magnificent videos for these rappers. I tell my kids the same thing. Number one, life is very, very short. Don't take yourself that seriously. Number two, Mel Brooks would tell you, relax. None of us get out of here alive, so take a chill.
Yeah.
And then number three, and this is the most important thing for my kids, I use a lot of four-letter words. You know, that got me fired from the White House. And thank God it did, because that would have been a disaster if I stayed a day longer.
Yeah.
But the worst word in our language for you, Jacob, and your generation is ought.
Yeah.
I'll spell it to you because I have a Long Island accent. O-U-G-H-T.
Sure.
It's the worst goddamn word in the English language. I never want to hear one of my kids or one of the people that work with me or one of my partners say ought. You know, it ought to be this way. I ought to get a 28 on the ACT or a 36. I ought to go to Boston College or Tufts, or I ought to, or this was unfair. No, that's not it. Life is, it's not ought. Okay. Yeah. It's not the word should and ought, take them out of your vocabulary. Embrace your life for what it is. I never had a grievance or a grudge against somebody that was born into privilege and had an accelerated advantage over me and perhaps did better than me in life as a result of it. Who cares? Live your life. Embrace who you are as a person.
Yeah. Well, you know, kind of tying it with, you mentioned the White House. Do you mind talking a little bit about those 11 days at the White House serving under Trump? Could we start by, you know, Could you talk about the first time you met Trump? I'm sure it was probably in the 2000s, 90s, maybe.
Yeah, I can tell you exactly. The first time I met Trump, I was 31. I was working at Goldman Sachs. It was 1995. It was the summer of 1995. And I went to Trump Tower with a gentleman by the name of Mike Fascitelli. And I met Donald Trump. And Donald Trump at that moment in my life was a novelty. He's a very high profile person. When I was 24 in 1988, I read his book, Art of the Deal.
Yeah.
And like every 24-year-old of my age, we're like, okay, Trump is the man. Remember, before he started acting crazy, okay, the rappers liked them. They would put him into rap songs.
Yeah.
And people like me were like, okay, this guy's living large. You know, he's got a helicopter and a fancy penthouse apartment, and he's going for things. And he had a New York style to him, this New York bravado. So I wanted to meet him. I was a very impressionable young person. This is before I met legions of luminaries and realized that everybody puts their pants on the same. And so when my boss asked me to go meet with him, I was like, yeah, I'm going to go meet the guy. So I went to go meet him, 26th floor Trump Tower. I can tell you for certain, Donald Trump did not remember meeting me. You know, I was a nobody.
Yeah.
And so there I was at age 31, and he had all that bluster and that bravado, and we never ended up doing the deal with him. That's the first time I met him. And then I ran into him a few times on the charity circuit in New York. And then I happened to be working at CNBC when he was at NBC. And I went to a few parties where him and Melania were there. And he was always gracious. I mean, he was always nice to me. Yeah. My grievances with President Trump are not of the personal kind. They're of objective analysis of what he's doing as the American president and how destructive his message is to the American democracy and the ideals of Americanism. It's not, you know, I hung out with him, liked him. He's a good storyteller. He's a good jokester. I had a lot of fun with him on the campaign. I really got to know him in 2012 when we were both working for Governor Romney on the fundraising side. You know, and Mr. Trump had endorsed Governor Romney in 2012, and he was frustrated with Mr. Romney's loss. He said he was going to eventually run for president as a result of that loss.
Did you take
And so we got close. I wasn't with him. I was with Scott Walker, and then I was with Jeb Bush. I was not with Mr. Trump, and I got to him late. I got to him in May of 2016.
Did you take his campaign seriously at first, or?
No, of course not. I wrote about that in my book. I said, I laughed at him. He said, I had breakfast with him the morning after The Apprentice was over. He said, wasn't I great on TV last night? Do you see me on TV? I said, no, I didn't see you on TV, because you were the only one. You were the only one that didn't see me on TV. We had amazing ratings and I was great, but I'm going to let you know something. I'm done with The Apprentice. I'm running for president.
Yeah.
I laughed. I said, you're not running for president. I mean, come on. It's another publicity stunt.
Yeah.
But listen, he's a competitor. Look, he's a competitor. He saw something in the American economy. He saw something in the American experience that he exploited. I think, you know, Secretary Clinton, you know, probably had some shortcomings in that campaign. It was a combination of things.
Yeah.
And he won the presidency. And by the way, I was there helping him, you know, and I don't want to overstate my significance to the campaign. He propelled himself to the presidency and carried the rest of us with him, but I was there trying to help him.
Yeah.
I just didn't think he was going to act like a lunatic once he got the job. I thought he was going to be a lot more.
As a person.
Sorry?
Did he change as a person?
No, I would say we all do things in our lives that we have to be careful about. We transform and impose upon people what our wishes are, not who they really are.
Yeah.
And so there's an expression that it translates from Italian, you can't put into somebody what God left out. And so what we wanted from Mr. Trump, it was not something he was capable of. We wanted a postpartisan transformative leader that could bridge the gap in Washington. We wanted somebody that could come in as an outsider and see if they could reduce the conflict in Washington and get real progress done for the American people. And, you know, we had those hopes for President Obama. He got, you know, hooked into the blue tribe. We had those hopes for President Trump. He got hooked into the red tribe. I don't want to be cynical. I'm hoping that there will be a leader. Maybe it'll be somebody of your generation that will be able to pull that off and sort of heal the divisions and the cultural divisions in the country. And so those are my hopes. I don't think he's necessarily changed. You know, somebody said to me, well, you were supporting him in 2015. And I said, no, I wasn't. That's when he said that the Mexicans were all rapists. I said, I started supporting him in 2016. And then they gave me a list of nasty things that he said. And he said, so, you know, President Trump hasn't really changed. And so why did you switch your support? And I said, well, you know what? He hasn't changed, but I have changed. Okay, yeah. The experience that I had, the humiliation of my firing, the eye-opening experience of how Washington works has made me more empathetic. It's made me more psychologically minded. And it's made me realize that there's a sacredness to our country.
Yeah.
And that we have to advocate for that sacredness. So, you know, I'm not making it to where I am, Jacob, in any other country.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, if your dad's a crane operator in Italy, guess what? You're likely going to be a crane operator.
Yeah.
You know, you're not getting into Harvard Law School. The levels of meritocracy, there is some aristocracy in our country, and we both acknowledge that, but the levels of meritocracy do exist, and I was able to take advantage of that.
Yeah.
Is it less so today for your generation? Perhaps so. I don't know. We have to see if we can make it better. What we can't do is give up. We can't be overly cynical.
Yeah. So can we talk a little bit about those 11 days, especially the emotional like roller coaster that it probably was? So when you started, I guess it was some form of pride. And then when you ended, you know, you kind of got made fun of by all of these talk show hosts and whatnot for a week. And then you were, you know, pretty, you know, unfortunately, or pretty sacked, you know, you were fired in a pretty unfortunate way.
Yeah, listen, I mean, look, I deserve to be fired. I mean, here's a lesson for young people. Acknowledge your mistakes and be accountable for them. I trusted a reporter. I said something off color. He was an Italian kid, actually from Cold Spring Harbor, my dad. I trusted the guy, and I said something off color. It was really fucking funny, though, okay? I mean, really funny. And it was true about Steve Bannon. I mean, the guy's a jerk off, okay? So I said it. It was something I regret saying. I didn't think he was going to run to the papers and report it on me. I thought he was going to hold that off the record. He didn't. He ran out and started telling people what I said. He wanted to get me fired. And I told him, I got on the phone with him. I said, wow, you're going to get me fired if you print that. And he, oh, it's an important story. You didn't say technically you were off the record. I said, okay, well, you and I we'll never talk again. This is very transactional of you.
Yeah.
And it's not clear to me that this is going to help your career, this one hit wonder of a story. But he wanted to do it and he did it. And then I said, okay, I'm getting fired. And on that Monday, I got fired.
Yeah.
And so, yes, was it humiliating? Was it rough? The late night talk shows, they can be rough on you. But this is what you learn about yourself when you go through something like that. Who fucking cares? Okay. I mean, yeah. Like I said about Mel Brooks, relax. None of us are getting out of here alive and no one's going to remember us. Just go enjoy your life. My son put together a 14-minute compendium of every late-night comedian making fun of me. It is actually hysterically funny. I'm so happy that it has not gotten out into the public domain.
Yeah.
But I went right on Stephen Colbert's show.
Yeah.
I was on a show a week after I got fired. Stephen said to me, did you think you were going to last a long time? I said, well, Stephen, I thought I was going to last longer than a carton of milk in the refrigerator. I didn't think it was going to get blown out like that.
Yeah.
My point being is you got to just roll with the punches. But here's the silver lining to that story. The gentleman that fired me, General John Kelly, I've become very close personal friends with. He's a terrific human being, 4-star U.S. Marine. He's a Gold Star family member. He's a wickedly honorable person, wickedly smart guy. And a result of our relationship and the way it started, which is obviously very difficult, we've become friends. And we also see the world very similarly. We love the country.
Yeah.
And we have been pretty candid, me more so than John, about President Trump and the shortcomings there. But listen, you asked me about the White House. I flew on Air Force One 3 times. It was a privilege to serve in the White House. I love my country. I made a mistake. It was something I wish I didn't do.
Yeah.
But the world has a very funny way of working itself out for you, because had I had stayed in the White House, I'm not certain I could have reclaimed my career, healed my marriage, and grown my business and be where I am today.
Yeah.
When the president fired me, and he didn't fire me, by the way, John did, General Kelly, he called me about a week later. He said, are you okay? I said, hey, Mr. President, don't have to worry about me. You made me as famous as Melania and Ivanka. and I didn't have to sleep with you or be your daughter. So I'm totally fine. You don't have to worry about me.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big lesson for younger people. Just be a big person, you know, be a big boy or a big girl and roll with it. You know, there's not you know, nothing you're going to be able to do about it.
Yeah. Do you feel like there was any role with like divine providence or faith in rebuilding your life after getting, you know, fired?
What do you mean, Jacob?
Just in general, like, you know, I'm a personal adherent to things work out for a reason. And I kind of attribute that to some form of religion. You know, that's probably my main like crux for why I believe in God is that things for some reason, when they go bad, they end up working out in the long run for me, at least. Do you think that, is that something you've experienced?
Well, I mean, like you, I have tremendous spiritual faith. I'm raised as a Roman Catholic. I'm a practicing Catholic. Am I sometimes a lackadaisical churchgoer? Sure, but I do believe in the Christian teachings, and I do believe in forgiveness and redemption and all of that stuff. And so I would say to you that there's probably some truth to that. I would say to you that when things are happening, they're experiences, they're trials, they're tribulations. And so you have to handle yourself in a certain way. You have to handle yourself with some level of moral principles, and you have to handle yourself with some level of humility for life. My White House firing was very humbling, but it also was a great learning experience for me. And by the way, you probably wouldn't know who I am had I not been fired from the White House. Maybe you would have, but maybe you wouldn't have. And so my life experience has been incredibly enriched by that firing, by that public spectacle. You know, there was a CBS, when I did the Celebrity Big Brother, they told me my name recognition for 20 to 40-year-olds was like 55%.
Yeah,
I laughed. And that's a direct result of Stephen Colbert and Jack Oliver making fun of me. You know what I mean? And I didn't care. Look, I got made fun of on Saturday Night Live, and then I was at the Met Yankee game, and I saw Lorne Michaels there, who's the creator of Saturday Night Live. He goes, "Mooch?" I said, "Lorne." I said, "How are you?" I said, "Let me ask you, I don't mind being made fun of on Saturday Night Live. Was there any chance I could get tickets to the Christmas show for my kids?"
Yeah.
He said, "Oh, no, terrific. We'll get you the tickets." And my point being, if I didn't get fired, I would never be taking my kids to Saturday Night Live. My point is there's always a silver lining, Jacob, you know, and when bad things are happening to you, you know, you have to see through it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a wonderful book that I would recommend to every single person that you guys get a copy of, every single person that listens to your podcast. And it's a book by Viktor Frankl. It's Man's Search for the Meaning of Life. His family, he's a young kid. His family is destroyed in the Holocaust. And yet he's so hopeful and he's so aspirational and so inspirational. And it just talks to what your human spirit has to be while you are encapsulated in this body of yours living on this planet. And I think it's a great message. And that book, when I was getting my ass kicked at the White House, I thought often of that book and what that man went through. And I said, "Oh, come on, this isn't so bad."
Yeah. Yeah, no, well, thank you for that. But kind of to tie it back a little bit more into Trump, you've kind of now pivoted your stance from, you know, being a very enthusiastic supporter to being more against him. And my question for you is, do you feel as though it's a house of cards that's about to fall? Do you think he's an Icarus type figure? What would you say?
Well, listen, I mean, I don't think he's handled the presidency well. I mean, I would just say to you, if you and I were on the board of a publicly traded company and we were evaluating the executive of that company, we would have to seek that person's removal. He's mishandled the pandemic. He's destroyed the economy. He's told 20,000 lies to the American people. He's fractured our alliances with the Western democracies, the peace-seeking Western democracies. He's praising dictators and autocrats. I mean, who does this? You know, it's not, and I find it very odd. There's a very large group of people that are still supporting him because of the great culture war in our country. You know, there's 70% of the people are white. They fear darker people. I don't know why. I mean, we could talk about that. I mean, there's probably 200 podcasts we could do about that. And Trump preys on that. You know, I mean, he's sending out a racist dog whistle on his Twitter account. Don't have any lower income housing in Jericho or Port Washington. Don't worry about that. We're not going to bring the crime to your suburbs, i.e. no dark people in your suburbs. White people, please vote for me.
Yeah.
I think it's very un-American. I think it's very, very dangerous. The country's first name is United. He is trying to disunite us. I tried to stay loyal to him. I got fired. People say, oh, you're a disgruntled employee because you got fired. No, that's not true. I tried to stay loyal to him for 2 years. But when he kept it up and he kept up this nonsensical behavior, I raised my hand and said, okay, I'm sorry. I can't support that anymore.
Well, so my question off of that is, do you think he's an Icarus figure where the same thing that like pushes him to the national forefront and, you know, has helped him get into the presidency is what's tearing him down? His personality, his behavior, his erraticism.
Well, I'll tell you what, if he loses and you invite me back on the podcast, I'll tell you that he was an Icarus-like figure, but he is a little bit more malevolent than Icarus. Icarus was just more naive. You know, the president knows what he's doing. You know, I'd have to think of another mythical character that's equally tragic to Icarus. You know, he is more malevolent. There's a meanness to the president. There's a maliciousness to the president. And I think that for some reason, many of his supporters like it. I never liked that part of his personality.
Yeah.
And this is one of my shortcomings that I have to own. I chose to ignore that aspect of his personality because I was equivocating over the policies. I was choosing his policies over Democratic policies because I'm a lifelong Republican.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess the final part of the podcast is just asking you a little bit about, you know, career advice for young professionals. The first I'd like to, I think you kind of alluded to it, but it would be, you know, interesting to just get a specific piece of advice, which is dealing with anxiety, especially career anxiety that's kind of happened due to COVID-19 and just the uncertainty going forward for young professionals and college students.
Well, I mean, again, here's what I would say. You have to expect the unexpected. You know, anything you think can happen in life can happen. And this is unfortunate. We want an upward glide path and experience things smoothly. But that doesn't happen in life. So COVID-19 has probably hit everybody, of course. But I think younger people are probably more frustrated about it because you're in the early foundations of creating your career and creating your way of life. And this has been a setback. And so, when you're 24, 6 months feels like a long time. When you're 56, it feels like less of a period of time. So I would tell people, this is a big learning lesson for younger people, that you got to roll with things. You got to adapt and pivot. You've got to say, okay, this is happening. It's not just happening to me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's no comfort in that, but it's not like it's isolated to you and this is specifically happening to you as a person. It's happening to 4 billion people.
So then
what we have to do is put it in historical context. You know, imagine if you were back in the 1918 pandemic where we didn't have as much understanding of the science of it and we made even bigger mistakes. You know, it's unfortunate that we have this kind of leadership. The president lies about the science. He disfigures the truth. He's telling people wearing masks or not wearing masks is a political statement. It's sort of bizarre, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you kind of alluded to like, you know, opinions of other people and dealing with peer pressure. You know, how did you deal with, I guess, the peer pressure of being, you know, a first generation college kid at Harvard and then, you know, first person in your family to work at Goldman. And then also the peer, you know, the opinions of other people when you left the White House. How are you able to center yourself or ground yourself?
Well, listen, I mean, you know, my grandmother said something to me that I actually believed. You know, what other people think of you is none of your business. If I spent time on what other people think of me, you know, I would be overly occupied. I'm living my life. I'm living my dream. I'm doing the best I can as a human being. You know, living well is the best revenge. I think maybe F. Scott Fitzgerald said something like that or Oprah Winfrey. I can't remember, but point is, you know, just live your life. You know what I mean? If you got haters, too bad, you know?
Yeah.
I don't hate anybody though. My attitude is, you know, I don't, if someone's hating on you, it says more about them than it does you. I don't have the time to hate on other people. I'm occupied with what I'm doing in life, you know? Yeah. And if people don't like my opinions or they don't like the way I speak or they don't like where I'm from or my family of origin, who cares?
Well, and how do you do
it? I don't spend any time on it. And I didn't spend any time on it after I got fired from the White House. I don't spend any time on it now. I'll tell you a quick funny story. When I got to the White House that first day, Kellyanne Conway took my phone And she said, give me your phone. And she turned off all the notifications on social media.
Yeah.
So I don't even know what the hell's going on. I sent out a tweet. I don't look at it. I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
You know, and my point is, you would be way better off in your life. And if you could only remember one thing from what I'm telling you young people that are listening to this podcast, be way better off. Like, nobody gives a shit about you. They do not give a shit about you. Even if they're talking about you, it's more a reflection of what's going on with themselves. Okay. You know who they give a shit about? They give a shit about themselves.
Yeah.
And so what other people think of you, no big deal. Just go live your life. Go enjoy your life. You'll have 5 or 10 friends. You'll have some great family members. And you can live a great life.
Yeah.
You can't worry about what other people think of you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, kind of a weird transition from that, but you know, a lot of things that have been happening with college students is a big frustration with, you know, the people in power in the system today, and specifically stuff on capitalism. I know that you had a specific situation that happened at Tufts where you weren't able to, you know, get a position that you were originally online to get. And then also, you know, could you talk a little bit about frustrations that young people may have with, you know, capitalism?
Well, I mean, listen, I mean, that is a big deal. You know, the capitalism is under assault right now, you know, because what used to happen is you had capitalism and this would create very powerful companies. And then the government would come in and they would demonopolize those companies. They would break up those companies so that you could create more innovation and more economic activity. And so what's happening right now, there's like these monolithic companies that are sitting on. And so people are taking economic rent from those companies. If they're in their companies, they're the lucky ones. And if they're not in those companies, it's harder to build your smaller businesses. Imagine all of the wealth that's been transferred to Amazon during COVID-19 from small businesses on local main streets. And so, you know, we have to fix that. And so if we don't fix that, what will happen is younger people will have a disregard or a disbelief in the fundamental philosophies of capitalism. But capitalism is a complex thing. There are winners and losers, and there should be unlimited outcomes. But the flip side is the government has to figure out a way to create a platform of equal opportunity. So if you're born in Jericho, you're going to go to a good school system. If I'm born in Port Washington, I'm going to a good school system. Suppose I'm born in an inner city to a poorer family.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? We have to figure that out. You know, there's ways now through technology. There's ways now through educational innovation. We need to figure that out. We have to do it, frankly, in harmony with the teachers union. We're not going to be able to do it without their help.
Yeah.
You're not going to have enough charter schools to solve the educational problem. It's got to be solved through the public school system. And so we have to figure it out. And it's going to require some toughness and some tough choices. But my point is, if we don't do those things and we leave things exactly the way they are in the status quo, people are going to grow up and be disaffected by capitalism.
Yeah.
They're going to think it's unfair. And then you're going to get something even worse. You're going to get the AOCs of the world to come in and say, no more capitalism. And let's have a command control structure where the government is mandating things. That'll be a disaster.
Sure. Sure. Well, I guess my final question for you would be, what do you think the legacy will be of Anthony Scaramucci? And then what do you think the legacy will be of Donald Trump? And how intertwined do you think those two will be?
Well, I mean, listen, I don't know what my legacy is going to be, and I don't care. And I would say something to you that I've said to my kids. If there's only going to be one person that's remembered from our era. And I'm talking about from like 1850 to 2250, that 400 year period of time. I give you an example, 10,000 years from now. Imagine the earth 10,000 years ago, there's a couple of pyramids standing. We know a few names like Cheops. We have no idea who the person is.
Yeah.
And that will be us. No one is going to remember us. However, from 1850 to 2250, there's one person that will be talked about 10,000 years from now. Who's that person? And remember, it's not Jesus or Muhammad because they weren't born 1850 to 2250.
Yeah.
I'm talking about somebody in this era that we're living in, this 400 year period of time, one person. No one's going to remember Donald Trump. No one's going to remember me. One person. And that's Neil Armstrong. He is the first person to leave the earth and to set foot on an extraterrestrial area of the universe. That's it. No one else is going to be remembered. So I tell my kids, I tell my friends, just live your life. You know, I'm not worried about my legacy. I'm trying to be a good person. We talked about religion. I'm fundamentally grounded in trying to be charitable and kind towards people. I'm not perfect. If someone's coming at me, I have to defend myself. I will go after them very, very hard. But the flip side of it is I'm a good person in my heart. The President Trump, what will his legacy be? 50 years from now, people will study him and say, okay, that was demagogic. He was acting as a demagogue. And will his demagoguery have hurt the country or helped the country? I don't know. But demagoguery usually doesn't end well.
Do you think he'll live to regret it?
No, I don't. I don't think so. No, he doesn't regret things. You know, he doesn't think like that.
Well, thank you for your.
I mean, he could end up in jail. He could end up in jail. I mean, if he doesn't get elected, I mean, he's probably going to jail. But I don't think he's going to live to regret it. All right, man. You be well, Jacob. Okay.
Thank you for
bringing me on.